Hey guys, and welcome to the Mobility Podcast. I'm your host, Pete Gould with Catapult Policy Strategies, and I'm joined by my co-hosts,
Greg Rogers of Twitter at AVGregR, and also of Neuro, but I do not represent Neuro on this podcast.
Well put, Greg. And this is Greg Rodriguez, also on representing Twitter and at Stantec, but also not representing Stantec.
Or Twitter.
As part of this podcast, or Twitter. As always, views are our own.
And we're still allowed on Twitter, too, which is great.
Yes. I'm very excited. We have an amazing guest today with us. A friend, former colleague, and just absolute rock star in the transportation, land use, equity, basically everything involving the way things should be. Her name is Beth Osborne, and she is the Director of Transportation for America. Beth and I previously worked together at USDOT in the policy shop, where she also was just, again, an absolute force on so much of the policy going on in the Obama administration. She's also had the distinct pleasure of working on Capitol Hill in both chambers for Senator Carper, who's now incoming, soon-to-be chairman of the EPW committee, and also in the House. So Beth is, again, currently she's the director at Transportation for America, which is Smart Growth America's transportation arm. She leads the transportation policy development and technical assistance with departments of DOTs across the state or across the country. And so, again, Beth, thank you so much for coming on, and it's really a pleasure to have you.
Oh, it's fun to be here. And I am representing Twitter. I'm kidding. I couldn't let it go. Sorry, Twitter.
And I have some announcements to make. Yes, it's anyway, I mean, before we really dive in, we quickly address the craziness that is this last week, month, year, everything. It is just absolutely shocking, as having someone who has worked on the Capitol Hill, it was just really gutting to watch, and just a sad moment that is going to, I think, have a lot of repercussions going forward. But our hearts really do go out to everyone affected, not just the lives lost, but I think there's a lot that is going to be unpacked over the following months. So I just wanted to kind of put that out there. I know everyone really, as much as things get heated, we do have a strong love and affection for the institutions that were under attack, and we're hopeful that soon there will be better days ahead in many fronts. But
Pete, I just want to add to that we think a lot about the members of Congress, but we forget that they all have staff. And having been a former staffer, these are people who work incredibly hard and have been doing so under very difficult conditions through COVID. And they were also very much affected by this, some of them being present. And so let's not forget that the people who make the government run and that do the day-to-day work are also being horribly affected by this. And let them know that we remember them too.
Yes. No. And not being there, I don't think actually really lessens the psychological impact. So we to all those staffers out there, we feel you, and we do. I think it's important that everyone reaches out and has each other's support. So, with that being said, let's look to what was supposed to be such a great year and so much optimism. We finally. Luckily, we got rid of that awful 2020 and are into the savior year of 2021 that has turned out a little bit differently so far. But obviously, the big news was last year in November, we have a new administration coming in. We had a Democratic House. We were waiting on January 5th to find out if there was a shot that a Democratic, very slim majority in the Senate might happen, and it did. And I think a lot of that's gotten lost, but that has huge impacts, on this Congress and this administration's plan forward. First things first, Beth, I'd love to, to start by talking about, we've named the incoming transportation secretary, and it is, I guess, I don't know if it's Secretary Buttigieg formally, but Mayor Pete or Secretary Pete, and I'd love to hear kind of what your thoughts and what you hope to see.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really excited about the nomination. I've gotten to work with Mayor Buttigieg. I actually got to meet him when he was first elected and came to DOT. And I don't know if you remember, Pete, but the whole building was a buzz. I remember our government affairs staffer saying, all right, I'm just going to warn you, this guy's supposed to be a rock star and everyone's going to be really excited about it. And sure enough, he lived up to the hype.
I read a fawning coverage of that in the from Eno by a young intrepid reporter who was just head over heels about him.
I have no idea who the young intrepid guy is anymore, but I think it sounds like it might have been around the same time. Yeah, he was just incredible. I mean, there's already this electricity as soon as he came up on stage. Anywho.
And say the same things everybody says. He really got into the details and would roll up his sleeves and he came and asked questions. He didn't come and tell. He came and asked, and that was really neat. And we had really cool conversations about what was possible and what wasn't. And he understood, you know, where the various pressure points were. Just quite astute. And then as mayor, even in my current job, you know, my sister organization, which is actually part of my team, is the National Complete Streets Coalition. And we've worked with South Bend a couple of times on what South Bend calls safe streets projects, mostly focused on improving the safety for vulnerable users like bicyclists and pedestrians by slowing down traffic, particularly in residential areas, and using inexpensive interventions like paint and temporary bollards and things like that to make a difference. And they've had great success. And it was really fun to work with his team, who were extremely creative. So, I have high hopes. I love what he said right upon taking office. I loved his platform on transportation when he was running himself. So super hopeful that he's going to both set a good course, but also translate that good language into action, much of which does not need to be legislative. In fact, a lot of legislative language runs headfirst into procedural problems that are just old, old tools, old rules that haven't been updated. And maybe he's the guy to do it.
Old Tools and Old Rules is actually the name of my yacht rock cover band.
I want to see the album cover.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question, Beth. So for our folks who are listening here who might not have worked in inside of a DOT policy office, what does that look like? What does the day-to-day in a DOT policy team look like?
I'll give my best answer, but I'm really interested to hear what Pete says as well. So I will say that it depends greatly on the DOT. One of the first things I was told by some of the folks who were outgoing from the Bush administration, who were very generous with their time and met with us to let us know where all the, you know, the proverbial bodies were buried and what to be prepared for, was that the policy office has the least authority of the offices and the secretaries, whole team. You've got budget, obviously, they're in charge of the money, they have a lot of power. You've got council, they've got the law behind them, that scares people. You've got intergovernmental affairs and congressional affairs, who are generally talking about who's yelling at us, so there's a lot of oomph there. But policy, everyone can kind of do without policy. So to have an effect, you have to show folks where you will be useful to them as well. And so I worked a lot to hear what the various parts of DOT were having trouble with and were looking for, and worked with them so that when they sent stuff our way for approval or wanted to take an action, they saw me as a partner in that. And I think a lot of a successful policy office is having a good understanding of, you know, what are the procedures and rulemakings that are coming up to us for approval? What are the reports that are going to come through that we're going to make a statement on? What are the competitive grant programs? How do we communicate what we are funding and what we're not, and make people understand what we're doing so they feel that it is fair? And where are the levers with Congress to shift legislation, either through cultivating good relationships on Capitol Hill so they turn to you for help, or by putting forth proposals? So I'll say that in a lot of ways, the policy office is more like a Hill office than any other part of a department, where you're kind of reacting to stimuli from all different directions and trying to keep your eye on the long-term game while dealing with the latest fire.
Fascinating. Pete, do you have anything to add on top of that? I'm really interested to hear what it was like in the Obama DOT.
Well, I'll say there's also a lot dictated by kind of, like she said, external stimuli, but also almost like where you are in the administration. So like the, you know, and I think you're going to have a as close to a case study of coming back into economic downturn, large economic stimulus, you know, hitting the ground, sprinting, running into a fire hose, whatever analogy you want to, you want to talk about that the Obama folks faced on day one. And so that is more of a setting things up, I think Cash for Clunkers is a great example of just Congress kind of saying, here, do this. And it's like, we don't do, dealership rebate type programs to the Department of Transportation. And it's like, great, but you need to do this really quickly and at mass scale and nothing that embarrasses anybody. So, there's a lot of that in the early times. And then I think what'll be fascinating is, what we saw early was the Tiger program. And that is a large pot of very broad money that really gave the department, as an extension, the policy shop, a lot of kind of like power, but just ability to do things instead of just talking about them. And so I'll be fascinated, the Tiger that became billed and somehow went from trying to be zeroed out to being doubled is a lot of money. I have a feeling don't get Beth started on the suddenly Tiger or build is double, but
I think it's important for everyone to recognize that I am a graduate of Louisiana State University undergrad and law school. So losing the Tiger name was a personal blow.
That is, I think, number one question of what will be done with the name of that program. but I will say, and the other thing too is that there really is without eyes and ears and foresight of knowing what's coming next, both externally and internally. Otherwise, it would just be the stovepipe modes doing their things without. And so like the policy shop really does have a very good, important role in seeing that big picture and ensuring that the president's and the secretary's objective and vision and kind of priority themes are woven into all of that. And that there's like a coherent strategy to it, I think is how I would describe it.
Yeah. I mean, to the extent the law allows for you to do that. So much of the stove piping actually happens on the Hill and particularly in the Senate.
All right. So I guess, speaking of that stovepipe of the Hill, this has been described, between the incoming new Democratic White House, Democratic majorities, still slim in both chambers, an economic crisis, a pandemic, I've heard it described, and I think I kind of agree, is that you're looking at a once in a lifetime opportunity to pass a just significant forward leaning climate, an equity focused infrastructure stimulus / reauthorization. And so I'd love to hear, Beth, from your perspective, what does that what must that package include?
Yeah, and I will say up front, I don't know that a stimulus and a reauthorization will happen together. They very mm-hmm. well may, but I don't know for sure that that's what's going to occur. I will say I also don't know that it is as once in a lifetime as people think. Not just because we had unified government when Barack Obama was elected, and we did nothing with it on the transportation bill. In fact, we passed a terrible transportation bill. MAP 21 is a bad bill. And the FAST Act was a bad bill, and it was shepherded by a lot of Democrats that just wanted to keep the status quo, including, you know, famed environmentalist Chairman Boxer, who did really bad things with that bill to the environment. And we could not convince her that there were environmental effects of the status quo. So I don't know that this is as partisan, that reform is as partisan as people make it out to be. This really is a bipartisan program, but the bipartisanship has historically been to not look under the covers, not to peek under the hood and ask what you're really getting. It's just to pass the money around.
Yeah. Now, for our listeners.
Oh, go on.
Yeah, just real quick, for our listeners, what do you think were the bad things for the environment that were in the FAST Act?
Well, I'll start by saying that the program we have today is basically the program we've had since the 1950s. And this program does not have a history of producing great environmental results. In fact, it is the sector that is not only putting more greenhouse gases into the air than any other sector, it's the one that's growing. So the notion that if you put more money into the program that produced that result, but you'll get green effects all of a sudden, I'm sorry, I can't follow that logic. And that has had bipartisan agreement for decades.
Or that the problem is that we have not addressed the problems caused by it is because we didn't have enough money.
Yeah, the deal is we've spent hundreds of billions of dollars creating this problem. And if we just spend trillions more, all the problems will get better. It's a really weird way of thinking. And I can get into the details of why that is. But suffice it to say, when your past results are bad, you don't say, let's just do a whole lot more of it and hope for different results. So having said all that, I will say that there's been some very positive signs that this is, I don't know if it's a once in a lifetime thing. God, I hope I get very nervous about things being once in a lifetime. A lot of things, but it is kind of a coming together of a lot of really positive trends and signs. And, mm-hmm. and I'll go through a few of them. One is that we do have a secretary designate who seems very interested in where executive authority can modernize the program. There's a lot of procedures within the department that prevent good policy from being implemented. And a lot of it comes from just bad modeling that cannot tell how people will travel. They're not good enough to do it. And it's not the model's fault. And it's not even the model developer's fault. They were developed in the 50s and the 40s and the 30s by people that did the best they could. We just in transportation decided that accountability is not important. We don't look back and figure out how close we came to our projections and make changes. It's just not a part of the culture of the program. And we really don't take advantage of all the great new technology that's available to us. We also have, on the positive side, a House of Representatives that passed a pretty darn good bill that really did start to pull results in with spending. I don't care how much money we spend on this bill. I only care what we're going to get out of the bill. What will the impacts of the bill be? Will more people have access to jobs and essential services, whether they're fortunate enough to be able to afford one car per person 16 and over in their house or not? And what I saw out of the House was an attempt to see those results and to tie spending to those results and hold people accountable for failing. And the third positive sign is that Senator Carper, who is going to be the incoming chair of Environment and Public Works, has said they're going to start over on their bill. They're not going to try to tweak what was a basically status quo while he was in the minority. They're starting over. That is huge. And that really shows leadership. I'd also say that his ranking member, Shelley Moore Capito, has been quite a great partner on transportation, one of the most active members on better safety on our roadways, particularly for vulnerable users. So that's a lot of things lining up well. The last thing I'll say, though this is the area that makes me the most nervous, is there has been a hesitancy to talk about things that are, quote, shovel-ready rather than a good investment into the long term. And I think that that's positive. I do fear that that will go away and people will just say the fastest thing we can do and the easiest thing we can do is dump more money into this program that's produced a lot of bad results in order to create hard hat jobs. I would argue we can create hard hat jobs. We can put good, hardworking people to work in good paying jobs while producing something that will have lasting benefits rather than something that will have lasting harm.
Well, it's also a different recession.
Yes, it is.
That, like, it's not a prime the pump. We gotta, you know, it's that we had to, we are and continue to have to at least slow the pump because not doing so spreads a pandemic. And so the impacts of it are not the construction and you know, the things you normally see in an economic downturn. So the solutions, let's hope, address making long-term smart investments that do put people to work, but that are also improving the communities and all that. And also then on the kind of PPP package, you know, of ensuring that folks are able to get through this pandemic. And so it's a different environment. So the shovel ready is not the problem.
Well, and I also, I do feel that there's an appreciation for what we learned last time. There are just there is some gravity here that we have to keep in mind. Just because you dump a whole lot of new money on a program one time does not mean they all of a sudden have additional staff to move those projects or move that money, nor are they going to go hire a bunch of permanent employees for one-time money. It's why an infrastructure bill is not a great idea. If we're not funding infrastructure properly, let's fund it properly. But one-time infusions are sloppy, and they have serious problems with them. But the other thing is, we do need to recognize that infrastructure investments that were teed up before the slump were based on the world as it looked at this time in 2020. Are those the projects that we need at this moment? I don't know that they are. I don't know that the problems we were facing then are the problems that we're facing in the next 5 to 10 years. And so just because it's ready does not mean it's right.
Interesting.
Yeah. Building off of this, I think this is a really important discussion. You know, we've said the word stimulus, we said the word spending. But I think one big challenge, especially for Mayor Buttigieg, should be he be confirmed is trying to figure out a new model for paying for all this. I mean, I think all of us on this podcast are excited about the potential efficiencies that we'll hopefully start to see in the mobility system, including with electrification. But, you know, rightfully so, hopefully that means less trips to the pump. But as we know, we can't raise the gas tax. We're starting to get less money from the gas tax. And so, you know, as we continue to spend that, I mean, what do we think the new model is for paying for all this? And I really appreciate Beth bringing up, you know, tying spending to metrics and realization of goals. But, you know, I think a challenge that I'm just thinking a lot about is, you know, how do we have that conversation about how do we pay for this? I that's a question that's going to come up, right?
Oh, sure. And it's never been a matter of us not knowing the solutions for paying for something. I mean, we always come up with ways to pay for things we want to do. I'm reminded of what former Senator Corker of Tennessee said about this issue. If it's a priority, we'll pay for it. And if we don't want to pay for it, it's not a priority. I think the real issue is it's not really been a priority. So we haven't felt like anyone should put any real money into it. We want to pretend that isn't the case because it feels good to be in favor of infrastructure and it's always the go-to bipartisan issue. But it turns out there isn't a lot of enthusiasm for raising taxes or any sort of fee for it. Now, there's a million things we could do to pay for it. Before I get into that, I do want to point out that there's a fundamental flaw to a gas tax in the first place. A gas tax from the perspective of a DOT is most useful when you're burning a lot of it. So from a DOT's perspective, getting you stuck in traffic or traveling further is to their benefit for their budget. Efficiency harms their budget. So these consumption fees can be highly problematic if your goal is efficiency and keeping down the cost to the consumer. Putting that aside and recognizing there are limited ways to pay for things, we have a fuel tax right now. We will always have a fuel. Charge a fuel tax. It's not that hard. There's always a way to do it. If you want to keep the current structure, we can have a transportation tax on electricity. There will be issues about how you make sure you tax appropriately, but there's a million ways to do it. We could do a VMT tax. There's a lot of problems with doing it. But really the problem comes down to people don't want to be taxed for it. They want the tooth fairy to pay for it. And so long as that is the case, it will be hard to pay for. I think instead of talking about the funding up front, like if I went to the bank and said, I want a mortgage, and they said, great, for what house? I don't really know yet. Well, for how much? I don't know. Well, with what money? I don't quite know. I just want you to give me a mortgage. And then just trust me, it's going to be great. And that's kind of what we've done. Like, give me your money. I'm going to spend it on something. What
that's
is
also kind of how you do the mortgage process, but...
I'm going to pay for it with my salary and let me give you all the proofs of my salary. And we're going to talk about a realm of what I can afford based on that and what I can back up. And we're going to talk about a region that I'm looking in. There's all kinds of things to do for that. But here we're saying, hey, open up your wallet to me. Give me more money. I'm going to distribute it by a politically appropriate formula to a bunch of states to spend as they see fit. And we'll see what happens. That's not where you start. You don't start with giving your money. You start with, this is what I'm going to do. This is what I can back up. Are you interested in funding it? That's how you make a sales pitch. And we in this country have not started by making a sales pitch. And so hopefully we can talk about what we're going to accomplish with a transportation program and then ask people if they're willing to fund it rather than ask them for funding with a wink and a trust me, which is what we've basically done for the last couple of decades.
Which is probably why you see such success at the local level on referendum, which tend to be specific to a package of here's what you get for it.
Yeah, or just a more trusted agency because people have a sense of what they're working on and they feel a little more accessible. I mean, look, at the federal level, there is a problem with having a list of projects and there's always going to be a distance. So I think going back to being clear about accountability, what's being built, using modern tools to figure out how to target that funding, including the neighborhoods that will be impacted in the decision-making process. Those are the ways we make it more accountable, but then also just setting a vision. And right now the vision is to spend money. Give me your money, I will spend your money. That is my promise to you. Well, I'm sure the government will spend my money. I have no doubts about that. But what will I get? Will I get a roadway system in a state of repair? Will all the bridges finally be replaced? I've been in this business since the mid-90s, and in every reauthorization, they talk about our crumbling roads and bridges, and they need more money, and then they get more money, and we still have basically the same amount of crumbling roads and bridges. And I know that a lot of the road advocates point to the steady decline in roads and poor condition of the federal aid highways, but it is a slow decline for this amount of money being spent. And it's because they're spending 50% of their money to build new roads that they can't afford to maintain instead of repairing the old ones.
You know, I think a lot changed with the Senate runoffs in Georgia, but it's safe to say that the transit world and state and local governments may have been the big winner given the kind of dire straits that many are facing due to the pandemic. What is the state of transit and how would you like to see transit systems come out the other side of this pandemic stronger and but more importantly, better serving, you know, to their stated missions and not just to try to get back to what it was before?
That's a great question. And I think you're right. That is the biggest win. Transit has been so bipartisan through this. I do just want to revisit what a big deal getting all this transit operating funding over the last year was. There's a bright line history at the federal level that federal funding goes into capital expenses, buying, replacing, building new things. And then the states and the locals have to pay for the maintenance and operations, particularly in transit. There has been some operations funding and flexibility for very small systems, but not for urban areas. So the fact that not only did we pass nationwide operations emergency assistance to transit agencies, but did it for the big agencies and did it twice and did it on a bipartisan basis. That is a massive change in support for transit. I'd also point out that, it wasn't just bipartisan. It was covered in the press by reporters and reported from folks on Capitol Hill as that easy issue they'd get to after they got through the hard ones. So it wasn't even a hard-fought issue. Figuring out what direct aid to send, how much money to put into COVID testing, whether or not there would be election protection, those were the things that they were fighting over. But transit was, we'll finish that up in a quick minute at the end because we all know we're going to do that. That is a big wow moment and really goes to show both how far we've come as a nation in understanding the importance of transit in communities, but also in terms of how many communities now have and rely on transit. This used to be an urban program that was out of the Department of Housing and Urban Affairs. If you go way back to the beginnings, now the majority of the transit systems are for small communities and rural communities. There are hundreds upon hundreds of them. And I think that now folks on Capitol Hill are a little more aware of how many folks in their own community rely on it, and that we all rely on it because it doesn't matter that you can drive yourself to the hospital if the nurses and technicians and repair people who keep that hospital running can't get there because they don't have their own private vehicle. So I just want to start by saying that was a big deal. And we owe, all of all transit advocates and people who've been working in this area deserve some thanks, but also a real thanks to folks on both sides of the aisle for standing up for it and making such a bold statement on behalf of transit. In terms of going forward, the big holdup for transit getting the remaining support it needs to get the rest of the way through the pandemic has been that Majority Leader McConnell didn't want to bring up another bill. It wasn't. Mm-hmm. It didn't have anything to do with transit. It's really hard to move a transit funding for when the vehicle that you'd move it in isn't moving, and it has nothing to do with transit. Why it's not moving? So now with a Majority Leader Schumer, it is going to move forward, and there will be something for transit. So that is a huge, very positive change for the fate of transit. But I think you're right. There are other issues we have to think about going forward. I take a lot of faith off of the fact that throughout the pandemic, when there were local ballot initiatives, that the public supported them by a huge number. We still passed 70% of the ballot initiatives, including initiatives to expand transit, because the people are saying with their pocketbook that their future includes better transit. So I actually see really positive things to come. At the same time, through this whole thing where we're seeing members of the House argue that transit should receive as much money as highways, haven't talked about that in almost 40 years. That's really exciting. And then there are just some operational things. We need to get the transit agencies through the rest of the pandemic. And then we're going to be in a bit of a just societal change where we start to figure out how much we're all going to commute and how we're all going to commute. And, who like me can take care of the 80% of the non-commute trips outside of a car. A lot of the reasons driving didn't decrease as much as people expected by not commuting is the commute trip is a very small minority of people's trips. It's about 20, 25% of people's trips. And we as a nation in our program ignore the other trips because they don't matter to us. We only care about the trip that everybody's taking at the same time. So maybe going forward, we can talk about in transit and in roadways, how better to serve the other 75 to 80% of trips people take to the grocery and to school and to the bank and to the dry cleaner and to medical offices and all the other places we have to go on a very regular basis. And then the last thing I'll say is I'm really looking at the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control. In a conversation with me back in the early summer on transit, they'd put out a very anti-transit statement, assuming that transit was going to be a super spreader for COVID. And they said they didn't want to get ahead of the science on that. And I said, well, you're not going to do massive peer-reviewed studies in the next month. So what are you waiting for to know what is safe and what isn't? And the answer was, I don't know. So we started to watch what was happening in Europe and Asia, where people did go back to transit and didn't necessarily wear masks. There were things that they did over there to improve circulation and things like that. But transit never became a spreader. We didn't have transmission cases going back to transit. But here in the United States, the CDC actively tells people not to take transit. So they don't want to get ahead of science, except for they're just, I guess, instead of getting ahead of it, they'll just make it up.
Well, I'm guessing the CDC is based in Atlanta. I'm just going to go out on a limb and guess it is not, on top of
have a lot of transit station.
So we're half joking, but that plays very much into people's thinking of, transit, that is a, packed subway car and must be, in the terrible inner city when, if you drive from the suburbs to a large park.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there's something to it. I also think that, in fairness to those working at the CDC through this hard time, people were flowing in and out, and you weren't really getting transportation experts or people thoughtfully following these issues. So anyway, I'm hoping that they revisit this and start sending a more intelligent answer to the traveling public on what is safe and what isn't, so that as we start getting to move around more outside of our houses, that we have the information we need to make the decisions on how we travel. Like I said, it's going to be a time of turmoil. A lot of people in New York went out and bought a car, and then they discovered that they will never park it again and they will drive it forever looking for a parking space. I think that might not be such a great thing. There's been a lot of articles written about how awful it turns out that having a car is. We're really good at predicting those first order effects. I don't think we recognize that there's just going to be a lot of second and third order effects and pendulum swinging as we play this all out. So keeping transit available so that when as people get back to something closer to normal, it's there. That's got to be our goal.
Well, I think again, this discussion is really interesting because another thing that I've been thinking about and just, especially here in DC, I'm sure, all of us have noticed it. The amount of people buying cars here, used or new, is making me very nervous from a congestion standpoint once we come out of COVID-19. And I think that will push people back to transit. But then, especially for someone who takes the bus a lot, like myself, the bus gets caught in traffic unless we have bus only lanes. And it's great, there is investment going on in here in DC, but that is not a priority in a lot of communities, often for a political reason. So I'm curious to get your take on, I think this brings together a lot of this conversation is how do we reprioritize our use of infrastructure for more efficient movement? And how do we incentivize, mode shift? It's a challenging thing. We talk about all these great ideas, but we have yet to see them implemented. I know you have some very, counterintuitive ideas T4 America's put out around, tearing down some infrastructure. So I'm curious if you have any suggestions, especially, again, with the new administration coming in.
Yeah. Some of it is, right now, the reason people make the choices to travel the way they do is because we built the system to take away all the other choices. And there's a little bit of a, these are questions that we have to talk about, we have to ask, but a lot of times those representing the status quo, it's facetious. It's not a serious question. It's like, well, how do I get people to walk on a highway? I don't. So if you insist on building the arterial like a highway that is built to mow down anyone outside of a car, no, you're right. People will not, quote, choose to walk. So to some extent, we just have to get serious about what we're building and what we're doing and recognize that the way we built our system it doesn't give you the choice, and it doesn't just not give you the choice. It actively, stands in the way of people making those choices. So a lot of it is get the barriers out of the way so people can make the choice, make it possible to cross the road without having to walk a third or a half of a mile down the street to cross and walk back. You know, right now we've got all these rules on the books that say 300 people have to cross illegally a day to justify a safe built crossing. That would be like saying we will build a bridge as soon as drivers plummet into the river to cross at that place 300 times a day. You know, so I think there's a lot that we can do to make making those choices more attractive and even inviting. And I think we've all experienced it. You know, I grew up in a first ring suburb of New Orleans, and I went to school in Baton Rouge, and I didn't walk or bike because it was terrifying, if humanly possible. But I moved to DC and I never drove because it was kind of a pain and because there are a million other ways to get around and everything I needed was close to me. I didn't change. The built environment changed. And so I think we need to recognize that to a great extent. And your point about taking down roads, it's really just about taking down barriers. So in a lot of these communities, you know, there's a huge gulf between them and the businesses that are within visual range. And there's no way unless you can fly to get across it. And so what would be a short walk is a, you know, as the crow flies, is actually a long trip to get around the, you know, 6 to 8 lanes that separate you as a trench going through your neighborhood. So you see places like Rochester taking the inner loop up to grade. And now what would have been a huge walking trip to get around the trench that was, you know, in some places 12 lanes wide, is now just a straight shot and a much shorter trip. And now, sidewalks or not, frankly, that's an easier trip to consider. So sometimes taking down those barriers is the biggest thing you can do. Sometimes providing good accommodations so that there's just a place, there's a place for you on the roadway, a place where drivers can look for you, a place where it's clear you're supposed to be, is what it takes. And sometimes it's just putting the things you need anywhere near you at all. I mean, frankly, the way we build our communities where we put people far away from all the destinations they need to get to and all those destinations far away from each other, a sort of development approach created in the 1920s by Herbert Hoover's Department of Commerce to deal with the health problems they had a century ago, is the greatest method for creating the most congestion with the fewest people. You couldn't do better than that.
Well, and also the highways through the middle of the city didn't accidentally isolate vulnerable communities or create the vulnerability of that community per se. There was, you know, as we all read more and more, the there was a intent behind creating that other side of the tracks and preventing easy access to many of the downtown businesses as well.
Or to, yeah, I think there are some planning documents in some areas that talked about creating, quote, little Soweto's. And in other documents clearly said, we're going to clear the slums. And by slums, they meant the Black people. Yeah. So, yeah, and what's interesting is, you know, I often hear this refrain of, yeah, that was then, we just need to move on. But by not learning from it, it means that even more benign decisions now end up creating further problems because we never learned from it. If you never revisit, if you never check your numbers, check your math, check your homework, you never get it right, you never learn. And so now we've got communities that are taking those same highways that destroyed areas and they're at the end of their useful life. And just choosing to rebuild it is choosing to give 50 more years to the barrier, or looking to expand it could be saying, well, we need to save seconds to a little over a minute for the wealthier people trying to get through your community by this expansion. And the price you will pay is we'll just take a few more of your homes. And so a lot of the legacy of it lives on today, even if it doesn't have quite as explicit a racial intent, it definitely has very harsh impacts on the same color communities. So, yeah, I think we need to look at that really closely. We need to think about ways to rectify that damage. We need to make sure that rectifying that damage doesn't hurt the community further by rising property values, and look for ways to help those who've been harmed by those highways to be able to participate in the upside. And we've got a proposal out there on that. And then we've seen Senator Schumer propose parts of that proposal to go forward. I'm very hopeful we see something there. And then just also give the engineers the tools they need to properly predict what will cause trips to just go away. There's not one model in the U.S. that can predict if a trip is foregone. In this age of internet and online shopping, we have zero models that can figure out when you just will forego the trip or what that means. It's remarkable how old and dusty and antiquated the tools that we put in the hands of the engineers are. I don't know what we expect will come out as a result.
Yeah. So let's turn to one issue that I would love to really dig into with you. You know, one area where there does seem to be, it appears to be a lot of consensus, you know, in how we utilize a large federal investment in infrastructure to address climate change is in vehicle electrification and EV charging infrastructure. So first, let's start with transit. Should the federal government be paying for any new buses going forward that are not zero emission vehicles?
I think if our goal is to electrify, we need to be very careful about having a big program that replaces gas buses with gas buses and a smaller program that buys electric vehicles. That does not seem like a serious attempt to electrify the system. I think we need to think more about about the buses, particularly in transit. It's significantly more complex than that. It does require the rebuilding of all the maintenance facilities and a different type of maintenance facility, different skill sets for repair. And I was recently talking with a friend who works with the utilities, who says there are considerations in the type of bus you get that you need to think about in order to get the sort of power you need to a facility. So there's a lot more than just a bus program that needs to go into place for transit. But in the short run, I do think we need to be careful when we talk about electrification of transit. Sadly, transit is only 2% it's 2% of emissions, but that's because we just don't provide enough transit. Mm-hmm. So if we spend a ton of time converting transit to, you know, turn that 2% into 1%, and in the early years in expending the money to do that, have to cut service, we're not actually going to cut greenhouse gases in the near term or in the medium term. So I think we need to be clever about this and have a glide path that thinks about the entire maintenance and lifespan of that vehicle, and work with the transit agencies to do so, and make sure we do so while we're building the transit. Transit is so underfunded. When we put something new on it, it comes out of something else. And that's not what we're trying to do. We're trying to expand the service and make it cleaner. And so long as we bring the electrification and the VMT folks together, we'll get there. But I do hear a lot of rhetoric that tells members of Congress in particular that they don't have to worry about that VMT stuff. It's just a technological fix, easy. And that's just not how it works. We really need to be working in tandem. We wouldn't say we're going to make the HVAC system more efficient, but you can leave the windows open. But that's kind of what we're doing in transportation. So I'm hoping we can bring those crowds closer together. And I'm starting to work with more of the folks in electrification, making sure that they recognize that we need a full court press on transit vehicles, but not at the expense of the transit service.
Sounds like the perfect need there is actually a large top-down dollar investment number that could come with in a multi-year from a stimulus.
I agree with you there. There are certain things that require a real shot in the arm, and frankly, with transit, I'd love to see energy around transit that looks like the early days of the interstate program that says, you know, we're going to make sure X number of Americans have access to high quality transit. you know, transit that comes every 5 or 10 minutes or something like that. And conversion to electric is another place that it just requires a real commitment to the mode. So I am hoping that that's something we see, and I think that folks will be open to it.
Agreed. I think that's great. And Beth, you know, playing off some of the things we've sort of been exploring, I want to make sure that we mentioned this great report that Transportation for America put out last year, Driving Down Emissions. And it did a really fantastic job of laying out how we need that full multifaceted approach to reducing emissions. If you look at land use, transportation planning decisions, and a lot of the things we've sort of been talking about during this discussion. I'm going to ask you a little bit of a pointed question that I think some critics might have thought, which is, you know, at first glance, it might look to folks as if it was like an anti-EV report. But I think there was a lot more nuance in that, wasn't there?
I really appreciate that question. I will tell you, it's a very interesting world where on one side you have the opening language said electrification is essential.
Mm-hmm.
And the EV folks looked at it and said, this is anti-EV, because the next phrase was, but not. We cannot do this without electrifying vehicles. Full stop. The whole system has to be electrified, has to be decarbonized. It's just that won't do enough. You can kill people with an electric vehicle by badly designed roads. You can destroy our water quality and overwhelm the stormwater systems with the roads that take care of electric vehicles. You can destroy wetlands and wild areas that absorb the carbon with the infrastructure that supports electric vehicles. You can blaze through black neighborhoods with electric vehicles. And there's a lot of emissions. You can create a greenhouse effect just with the pavement to serve the electric vehicles. And over the next couple of decades, there are emissions we can take out today as electrification is happening by just making it possible for people to spend less on transportation and therefore have more equitable access to the things they need by just shortening their trips and allowing them to get out of their car. So they can emit less right now if we design our roadway system in a way that it isn't terrifying to cross the street. So the EV world is used to being dominant in the transportation sector, and being told that they're essential is hurtful. On my side, mentioned at all is a huge coup. I would love to get to a world where we both say that each other is essential. And I think once the electrification side can recognize that the VMT side is just as essential as we recognize they are, then we'll actually decarbonize transportation.
I think that's exactly right. You know, it's a both and. I think that, you know, all around, you know, whatever mode that you're on, I think that folks get frustrated with each other thinking that the other is suggesting that they're a silver bullet. But I think at the end of the day, any serious transportation professional realizes that that this is a partnership and this is an ecosystem. And, you know, hopefully it's not just, intermodal cooperation we see more of, but looking at land use decisions and figuring out how to consider the impacts of those. And it has been heartening to see that those discussions picking up more as well.
Yeah, and I do hope that people take a look at the report, because there is a lot that we can do that has great climate impacts, but the same changes save people money, save governments money, improve other environmental effects, and give people more equitable access to the things they need, all in one fell swoop. I just continue to not understand why that's not an exciting thing and is rather seen as a challenging thing. But I yet again, I am heartened. I feel like we're moving in a better direction on that. And I'm starting to see folks who have wanted the easy fix, will just change the drivetrain and everything will be fine, recognize that maybe we should all work together. And it's a reduce, reuse, recycle thing, right? It's not just use everything you want one time and we'll recycle it. we should reduce the trips. We should allow people to take trips in less carbon intensive modes. And we should make sure when they have to get in a car, it is zero emissions.
I think that's exactly right. And, you know, there are a lot of great graphics in it too. We'll make sure to put it in the show notes for folks. But there are a lot of good graphics that helped people, I think it really helped to grok some of these big, complex issues as well.
Talking about land, you really do need those graphics, in fairness. I mean, it's really hard to understand how people move based on how the landscape is laid out without some good graphics. So we have a woman who does our graphics work named Cecily, who's amazing, and the woman who led the writing of this document, Emily Mangan, who's now gone off to grad school, is just insanely talented. So I just have to say that I have an incredible staff that really helps make these things sing.
Yeah, you really do have a great team over there. And on that note, Transportation Camp DC is this Saturday. And thank you to T4A. And thank you to another great person at Transportation for America, Jennifer Fortunati, for helping to push that forward as well. So definitely encourage folks to, I don't know if their ticket's still available, but sign up for that as well if you're listening to this before that happens. It's on the Saturday, January 16th.
It's just a couple of days away, and it's an unconference. So you bring your ideas, you propose your own session. Your proposal needs to be in by Friday, and then you can run a session, or you can attend other people's sessions, some of which are presentations, some of which are conversations or activities. It's as creative as the folks who attend want to make it.
I feel like everything's an unconference these days.
Well, that's fair.
Well, Beth, this has been great, and we really appreciate your time and all of your work, not just recently, but throughout your career. You've been I mean this when I say you've been an absolute force. T4A has been an absolute force. Just having seen how the overall transportation, particularly at the federal level, conversation has been, you know, literally bent in your direction because of sheer force, is a real testament to the organization and to you guys. So thank you for that. Where can folks listen to you, your Twitter rants, as you're saying? Where can they find you online?
It's at Beth Osborne T4A. Follow, join in. One of the coolest things about being on Twitter is the information I gather there. When we put out our removing urban renewal highways, those highways that destroyed Black and Brown communities proposal, it was my CEO of Smart Growth America that posted it and invited people to share their own experiences or what's happened in their own communities. And we got a chain over 300 items long with rich with information.
That was really cool.
And we're hoping to turn that into a report. So that people can see it, and maybe an interactive map. God, I hope I can pull that together. I see this as hearing from other experts and learning from them, because that's where the best ideas come from, and seeing what people are doing at the local level, because there's some really exciting changes. Even in the time of COVID, it did force some creativity that we can learn from going forward. And that's why I'm there. I want to hear what other people are up to.
Perfect. Greg Rogers, where can we find you?
Yeah, I am at AV Gregar.
Perfect. Greg Rodriguez?
Yep, at Smarter Transpo. And I just want to echo, thank you, Beth. I always learn so much whenever I hear you speak, and you are a wealth of knowledge, which is so impressive. So thanks for your time.
Oh, thanks for inviting me. It was nice to hear y'all's voices.
Excellent. Yeah, thank you so much, Beth.
All right, guys. Everyone out there, hang in there. One day it'll be better. Wear your mask. Say something nice.
Ride your bike. Get outside. Go hiking.
Yes. Yes. And thank you guys so much. And we will be back soon with another episode.
Thanks, guys. Thanks, Beth.
Thank you.